You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions Special.
Episode
24. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
So this is our part two of our Leonard Nimoy tribute retrospective episode we put out a couple of Sundays ago, right after Nimoy's passing, our unscripted and kind of rough around the edges part one. And thank you to all of our listeners and supporters who sent us messages and commented on that episode. We really appreciate all of your positive feedback. It really hit home for us. It was an emotional episode. So
yeah, like you said, we did our sort of emotional day after tribute, and now we wanted to take an episode where we were really able to do a little bit more of that, sort of recognizing and celebrating Leonard Nimoy's life and career. And we've been fortunate to have a lot of really great talented people on the show since we've started, and you know, people that we've become friends with and people that we wanted to come on and share their thoughts and stories about Leonard Nimoy. So we've got a lot of great people on tap this episode.
Yeah, and forgive us in advance if this episode runs long. We've got quite a lot of footage from these guests, and I think this is going to be a wonderful tribute to Leonard Nimoy. And we're starting off with the creator of the Green Girl documentary. That is a documentary about the life and career of the incredible actress Susan Oliver, and that is Mr. George Pappy. And we're really happy to have him back on the show. He's been on once before talking about that documentary, and we'll have, of course, a link to that episode in the show notes, as well as a link to that documentary so that you can take a look at it yourself.
And you should take a look at that.
Absolutely
documentary.
Absolutely.
This is a tribute to Leonard Nimoy, but The Green Girl is really an incredible tribute to the life and spirit of Susan Oliver, which is, she was an amazing woman, and George paid her a great, great tribute by putting a lot of hard work into that documentary.
Oh, I think the love for Susan really pours out of that documentary. And Susan passed away quite some time ago. And when you watch that documentary and you look back on her body of work, and not only that, but her personal life and the things that she accomplished outside of acting, it's so worthwhile and such a great thing to look back on and realize her impact on Hollywood and acting and women in Hollywood. So I can't say enough good things about what George has done for that documentary, and please go take a look at it.
So I guess we'll jump right into our conversation with George, and I think we're going to sort of join it in progress, right?
Yeah, I think so. We're going to hit the ground running on this one. God, it's been a long time since we talked to you.
I know. I guess last summer, huh?
Yeah, it's a convention.
Yes. So you guys will get a kick out of this. I just walked by both places. Like, I don't know if I told you this before. I probably did, but I work where they filmed Operation Annihilate.
Yes.
Last episode of the first season.
Awesome.
I actually work in one of those buildings where they beam down. So I just walked by that courtyard where there was that big pond that they beam down next to. And then they get attacked by those guys screaming, "Run away from us, run away from us."
That's awesome.
That's our cafeteria with the red tiles. And I just walked by there. I was thinking about Spock when he goes back down alone, you know, after he's been infected with the space omelet or whatever that is. Yeah, I think about that a lot.
That's a really cool thought, because now you have, because you work in that place, you have that kind of personal connection with that episode of Trek, and that's something that I don't know if any of us or any of our listeners have.
Yeah, it's kind of it's one of those neat little coincidences. I have a couple of those. I have that one, and I also have from like 1980 to 85, my family lived in what had originally been Fred Freeburger's house. I think he owned it from about 69, right as Star Trek ended. In fact, I think you could probably say he bought that house with some of the money he made on Star Trek. And I don't know when he sold it. We bought it from another family. But I remember looking at the electrical panel on the with circuit breakers, and it had Freeburger written on it. It was clearly Fred Freeburger's house. So yeah, I've got that connection too.
Jeez.
Yeah. And I was really happy, by the way. I heard you guys had interviewed Mark Cushman, and I was really happy to see in his third edition of the book, you know, that the season 3 volume of These Are the Voyages, that he kind of exonerated Freeburger for a lot of the guff I know he's taken over the years unfairly. It's funny, you know, that whole thing, because I grew up largely, I told you this too, I feel this other personal connection. The final thing about Leonard Nimoy, you know, that's what we're talking about, the passing of him. This has got to have been the summer of 69, because according to the third edition there, the third volume, I guess NBC, their final airing of the episodes when it was still on their network, the reruns of summer of 69 were Tuesday nights at 7:30. So that must be what I'm remembering. But I remember very clearly running down the street to my house with about five or six other neighborhood kids as a toddler. And we're screaming, Mr. Spock is on, Mr. Spock is on. And we were going to go watch Mr. Spock. And this one kid to my right, my buddy Mason, he's going, yay, Star Trek. And I remember very distinctly saying, what the hell is Star Trek? We're going to go watch Mr. Spock. That's what I thought the show was called. I think that's what most of us thought it was called.
So as a sort of, I guess, first generation fan, George, and having Leonard Nimoy a part of your life for so long, what kind of impact did he sort of have on your overall outlook as it related to Star Trek?
I don't think there is a Star Trek without him. I feel the same way about Kirk. Those two characters, I think there is no Star Trek without those two. But he certainly is such an important part of it. Without him, I just don't think it exists. It's, oh God, there's so many things about it. You know, the fact that it makes so many statements to me about race relations, for lack of a better way of putting it. That's probably the way they would have put it back then. I mean, you could totally imagine ignorant people. Well, I mean, they did that, right? In that Nazi episode where they're talking about how he's clearly demonic and the forehead, he's obviously of inferior mental, all that crap that people do when they get into that mode of thought. And just this wonderful idea of something higher and more enlightened than just pure emotionalism. It's just such an important part to me. And the idea of the value of science and how science can be used for good purposes. It's almost like Kirk and Spock make up this higher entity, but they both bring something important to the table, but neither one of them is quite it. It's them together, you know. So, and I know personally, people have called me Spock before. They accuse me of being somewhat logical and intellectual, and I always took that as a compliment. It was a big deal to me. I always really, really loved Leonard Nimoy. I thought he was a great guy.
Do you have any particular moments from the original series that sort of stand out as some of your favorite Spock moments or your favorite moments for Leonard Nimoy, the actor?
Well, I'd say some favorite Spock moments. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful episode, The Naked Time. And it was wonderful that it appeared so early in the sequence, because I think it was a defining moment for the character. And I think his characterization was infinitely better because of that episode and in subsequent episodes and years, you know, where he he's struggling, and it comes to the surface. And that sitting in that conference room crying, I mean, that's, God, I'm getting a little teary-eyed thinking about it right now. It was such, that was really, really amazing acting, a chance for him to really, one of the few chances as Spock to really emote. That was a wonderful moment. And just really, I think, added so many layers of complexity and depth to the character. So that one for sure. I just love, iconic visually speaking, that moment. I forget the name of the episode, the one with the space amoeba, when the Intrepid, the all Vulcan spaceship dies.
The immunity syndrome.
He's looking
right
into his visor and he suddenly, that's it, immunity syndrome. And he just looks up with that look of horror because he just sensed the death of an entire ship of Vulcans. I mean, my God, that's a pretty amazing moment too. And of course, this one, I even wrote it into our script on something entirely different one time in a dream sequence, that him just saying, Edith Keeler must die. I think that's what he says, right? Those are the words. God, he was just a wonderful actor, and that was just a defining role for him. And those are some of the moments that jump out for me. It's so unusual. It was funny. I remember watching him on Mission Impossible some after that. And it was weird to see him smiling and acting all human. I just got to know. I know he hated it, right? I went and looked back. He published that book in the mid-70s, I Am Not Spock. And at that time, I can understand that. Because the other thing I remember him for, it was basically him playing Spock once again, was it was kind of a cheesy half-hour pseudo-documentary show in the 70s called In Search Of.
Oh, I love In Search Of.
They'd show it at like 7:30 on weeknights before primetime programming started, after the nightly news. And they were kind of pseudo, you know, they were cheesy things like, do aliens exist? What's the deal with the Bermuda Triangle? Is there a Loch Ness Monster? And he would be the narrator, right? And basically, even though he was Leonard Nimoy narrating, he was basically Spock narrating. You know, like, we'll get the logical science guy from Star Trek narrate this. And I think I can understand, really, it seems like all of them except Shatner, he seemed to have been totally immune to it. I think Star Trek in the 70s ruined all of the other regular series actors' careers until the movies came along. Because the reruns got so viral, so to speak, no one could see them as anything but those characters. And I think no one wanted to cast them because of that, which is a shame from their perspective. So I can understand him writing a book in the mid-70s called I Am Not Spock. And then what he does 21 years later, I Am Spock. He just had to own it, and saying, you know, fortunately for him, owning it was a good thing. By then, he'd gotten to be in all those movies and direct one or two of them, or he had directed other things as well.
Yeah.
So, it's funny. I think he wanted to escape it, and it ended up overtaking him for the better, whether he wanted it to or not.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating, and it's really rare to see a character and an actor that are able to span so many decades. If you look at his final work in Into Darkness, which he's playing Spock, and you know, it's almost 45 plus years of history there, and it's really rare for an actor to be able to do that. And it's really special that Leonard Nimoy got to a place in his life and his career where he was able to work out whatever he needed to work out with that character, put it to bed, and sort of move forward and give us this wonderful, you know, final set of performances.
I've got to say one other thing I love, and I love part of what I love is too his sense of humor about himself. And I guess you can say that about all of them, really, all of the original series cast members. But I appreciate the fact that he was willing to, and I think this was still back in the 90s, do a guest voice episode of Simpsons when they build the monorail.
Yes.
Yes.
And they're all stuck on it. It won't stop. And he's sitting next, I think, is it Lenny or Barney? One of Homer's buddies. And he's just going on and on about, you know, really the doors of the bridge were two technicians and we had to trust them. No, and finally looks over, the guy next to him looks over and goes, someone else want to sit next to this guy? Because he's just boring them all to tears. And I love the fact that he was willing to make fun of himself like that. You know, it shows that he had a sense of humor, which is easy to forget because he was Spock, you know.
George, you know, your work on the Green Girl, documentary, the documentary of the career of Sue and life of Susan Oliver. I was wondering, since the character of Spock is the only character to survive into the series proper, does that have any extra significance to you when you think about Nimoy and in relation to your own work?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like I've got a kind of an indirect connection to him. He shows up briefly on screen in a movie I made. That I love that fact. And I tried to get him to give an interview, but I made it as far as his publicist. He thought it was a wonderful idea and said he'd pass it along. And if I didn't hear back, that meant he wasn't interested. This came almost literally days before he announced he was done with Spock. Back, I think that was in 2012. And I understand, you know, at that point he was pretty old. He was probably 82 years old or 81. And, you know, everyone wants a piece of the original cast members constantly. So I realized they can't say yes to everything. The other thing, too, is when he died, I went back and tried to look and realized he doesn't show up, to my knowledge, in a single frame of film with Susan Oliver in that anywhere. He is not standing there with the rest of the crew when she first makes her entrance, when they're talking to the survivors. He's not in any of the shots where she's kind of laying it on heavy with Captain Pike and getting him alone so that he can be kidnapped. And then from then on, the only two other people from the ship that are with her briefly are Major Barrett and Yeoman Piper, whatever her name was. I forgot her name now. But so he may not have even really been on the set the same time as her, for all we know, or very little. I'm sure they were aware of each other. They'd done a wagon train together in 1960, I believe. And that's a wonderful wagon train, by the way, if you can find it. I'm sure you can. They're around. It's called the Maggie Hamilton story. And I did put a picture up of it when he died on the Green Girls site. He played an alcoholic Indian tracker who's being kind of abused and by these really bad cowboys that are using him to track her down. She goes running from the wagon train and they kidnap her. And he has a lot of that same internal turmoil and complexity he brought to the Spock character. So I'm quite sure they were aware of each other as actors, but they didn't really, it's funny, they didn't really end up sharing any scenes or screen time in the menagerie at all, or the original cage. But it certainly still did mean something to me that he is connected to that project, and I'm proud of that.
Well, that's awesome. And, you know, that you mentioning that Wagon Train episode and the role that he played in Wagon Train as opposed to the Spock character, I think illustrates the range that Nimoy had as an actor. I know that, you know, people always, you know, typecast him as Spock, and I think it's important to remember him as having the ability to be much more than that on screen. And that Wagon Train episode that you brought up, I think, is a really great representation of that.
I believe he did 3 or 4 Wagon Trains and tons of other stuff, a lot of the same shows that she did. These were very good actors, very versatile actors who worked often in television and film occasionally when they were lucky enough to. It was a kind of a dying time for film because television cast such a big shadow. But until Spock, he was not, I'm not even really aware that he was a series regular on anything, but he was a very sought after and frequently working guest star like Susan. So yeah, he really was versatile. You had to be. There was no way you were going to continue to be a working guest star like that unless you were very good and very versatile.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you had mentioned In Search Of, are there any, and The Wagon Train, are there any other performances outside of the Star Trek universe that sort of stand out as special in terms of Leonard Nimoy's career for you?
Well, I always thought he was cool in Mission Impossible. That was that one I remember. I did see him in a Columbo. I watched it not that long ago, and that one didn't quite work for me. And it might have been, as much as anything else, the script. I mean, those Columbos, they're so by the numbers, right? I mean, you know everything that's going to happen. Yeah, he played a surgeon in that one who kills someone, I believe, in the operating room. His car, and it's, I don't know, It was like I said, it was probably the script as much as anything else, but I do remember it. It was odd to see him playing a murdering surgeon like that, you know. But yeah, I don't know. You know, that those are just all interesting footnotes. I mean, that he will always be Spock. And I think he finally acknowledged that and embraced it. I mean, you know, look at his Twitter feed. I mean, he clearly was Spock.
Yeah, yeah.
And God bless him for it, you know. I was so saddened driving into the San Fernando Valley the day it was announced he died, and they were playing a tribute to him on the radio. And as I was looking down on the valley, I got a little teary-eyed. He's one of those constants that was just there my entire life. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of started to assume he would always be there. Imagine I'll be quite torn up the same way when William Shatner passes away, which one day he will.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are just big body blows. They're such icons for what they did on that show.
Yeah.
It was more than just about any other show you can think of in its impact.
Yeah, and it was especially the way that Leonard Nimoy embraced the fandom, and he called all of us his grandchildren. I mean, mm-hmm. It really felt like there was a connection there between us and him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just a really fine human being, you know, and I'm happy for him. I know he always wanted to direct, too, and I'm happy that not only did he get to do it on Star Trek, I mean, I had forgotten until he died, and I started to read his obituary. He had done Three Men and a Baby.
The highest grossing film the year it came out.
Yeah, 1987, I believe. That was a huge hit, mm-hmm. which also tells you he had a sense of humor. It's easy to forget that again because of Spock, you know. And I know he always wanted to direct. I mean, it was part of what he held out for after the first season of Star Trek. It was a shame for both of them. Shatner, too. I didn't know this, but Cushman said it in his book. Shatner was slated to direct the next episode if NBC hadn't cut the third season short by two episodes.
Mm.
So it's a shame it took. I really feel for those guys, Gene Roddenberry included. It must have been real tough from 1969 to 1979. You know, just sitting on hold and first not realizing you'd even really done anything more than just another show, even though maybe you enjoyed it and you thought it was important at the time, but then to see it get pulled out from under you like that. And then to sit there and watch it go viral, as I keep saying, even mm-hmm. though they didn't use that word back then, and not being paid a dime for it. That's one of the things, by the way, I love about, and I think that's why the fans have all embraced it, is Galaxy Quest, that opening of Galaxy Quest, painting that picture of what it was like for them, say, in 1977, when really the only thing they had were the conventions, and the conventions weren't even the conventions we have now. I went to the LA convention in 77, and they were nothing like what they are now. But I mean, you're an actor who often is not getting cast anymore because everyone knows you as Chekhov or Spock or Uhura, and they don't think of you as anyone else. And all you got is the conventions, and then Shatner seems to be immune to it and rolled in weight and a little bit of attitude. And that must have been very hard and frustrating, you know. My heart goes out to them for that. I'm just so happy that starting with the first movie, it kind of vindicated itself for all of them, but that must have been a tough 8 or 10 years.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it is great to see that the franchise pulled through and that there was a happy ending for just about everyone in terms of mm-hmm. I think you know, getting on their financial feet and getting a little bit of a career back out of it. Well, George, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts with us about Leonard Nimoy and what he meant to you. You've been a great friend of the show, and we are so glad that you were able to come on here and help us pay tribute.
Well, thank you. It was a tremendous honor, and I'm thrilled you asked me. You guys have been great friends to me, and so live long and prosper, my friends.
Same to you, George. Thank you so much. All right, so that was Mr. George Pappy, and we thank him once again for being on the show. What a great insight, and I'm really glad that he was able to hit on his feelings as it pertains to his work on the Green Girl documentary and Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting insight there.
Yeah, definitely. So our next guest on the show is an incredible, incredible guy. And we've had him on the show a couple times before this. And these are the Voyages. Star Trek books are being referred to as pretty much the Bible for Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah. Author Mark Cushman had dedicated a lot of time and energy to getting these books out for people to read and really sharing the story of Star Trek. And we'll address it in this discussion. Mark is always a great, great guest when he comes on. And it was a true honor and privilege to have Mark come on here and share his thoughts about Leonard Nimoy with us. And as always, we are pleased to bring on the show with us, These Are the Voyages author, Mark Cushman. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Craig. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Mark.
So, Mark, it's not the best circumstances to bring you on as we're sort of paying tribute to Leonard Nimoy here. And before we get your thoughts and feelings about Leonard, he had some kind of involvement with the books after the publication of the first volume, right?
Right, right. You know, he's had done so many books of his own, well, two, and he had done so many interviews over the years that he didn't feel he had anything more to add to everything he's talked about. So I didn't have his interview when we did the first book, but I got archive interviews from him because I wanted to get everybody's voices in there. And I sent him a copy of the book, and then he got in touch with me and ended up giving me an interview at that time. So we did the revised, expanded edition of book one, and then he continued on with book two and book three with his involvement. He was very gracious. You know, it just struck me so immensely that how much he cared about the character of Spock and the integrity of him as a person, as an actor, and why the character of Spock had such great integrity. And it just came from both Gene Roddenberry and Leonard Nimoy combining together to create that character. That's why we feel such a great loss with him, because we can hire other people to play Spock, but you know this was the co-creator of the character and the person who really put that human aspect into the character of Spock. Leonard Nimoy did have two sides to his personality. Read his books. Read I Am Spock and I Am Not Spock, where he has conversations with himself as Leonard Nimoy, and then as Spock, as they're talking back and forth. It's very, very insightful.
Wow, yeah, that's phenomenal, phenomenal. So, Mark, as we're listening to some of this information about Leonard and how he's contributed to the books, we had a prior conversation with some of our other guests on the show in regards to the development of the Spock character and the contribution that Leonard not only made to his character, but the evolution of Vulcans as a race and all of the other people who played Vulcans after him. And I was wondering, since you have such an insight into Nimoy and through the writing of your books, do you have any feelings on the impact that he had on Vulcans that came after him in other series?
Yeah, well, how can you not be influenced by Leonard Nimoy? I mean, that's the one that we all look to. He'd like be the teacher, you know, how we all learned about Vulcan from him through his examples and his performance. So I think anybody who does a Vulcan now, you know, was watching him to see how they were supposed to do a Vulcan. And everyone who's in the new Star Trek movies, you can tell that they watched the original series. You can tell they've done their homework. There's a little bit of Shatner sneaking in to Chris Pine, and there's a little bit of Spock sneaking in and so forth. So it's coming across that they are not just doing the character of Spock. He's doing Leonard Nimoy doing Spock, you know, and adding his own spin onto it. But you can definitely see the tribute that's being paid in the way that they do these characters. Leonard Nimoy, you know, he came up with the Vulcan salute. He came up with the nerve pinch. But my God, that guy could do more with a raised eyebrow than any actor who's ever lived. Just a little twinkle in the eye. I mean, because he had to, you know, Martin Landau turned the role down because he was thinking, well, there's not a lot I can do with this character. Nimoy didn't see it that way. Nimoy, being a method actor and being such a serious thinker about things, you know, he really got into all the nuances. And, you know, give him a camera for a reaction shot, and he would give you the tiniest little thing, but it would be gigantic.
Yeah. Do you have any particular favorite moments from the original series where you think Leonard either had a really great performance or there was a great character moment for him to play with there?
I was always very taken, I think, as all of us were, by Devil in the Dark. I mean, when I watched that, I think how brave of him to do the mind meld the way he did. Because, you know, when you're shooting that, you don't know if people are going to be impressed or if they're going to be laughing at you. And that's really going out on the limb as an actor. The same way with Shatner going out on a limb, confessing his love for the Enterprise, or, you know, or letting Michael Dunn ride on his back and play those stepchildren. It's really taking a chance. That camera is in really close. You know, 20 million people are going to be watching that night, you know, when it was on the network. And my God, how do you even deal with that when you have to act out that type of a role? You know, Naked Time, which was very early in the production of the series, I think, what was that, the fifth episode they shot? Maybe the sixth episode, and they that scene of him having the breakdown in the briefing room was done in one take. They shot that at the end of the day. Wow. And the Mark Daniels said, we got time for one take. And that's why when you watch it, there isn't any cutting. The camera, Spock comes in through the doors, and the camera follows him over to the seat, and he sits down, and the camera slowly circles him as he's going through the mathematical equations, and then pounding his fist on the table and admitting he could never love his mother and the whole bit. You know, it's all one take. Now, when Kirk comes in, then they're getting coverage of the two. But that one scene of him doing the confession to the empty walls and to the camera was done in one take at the end of the day. So he got it right in one shot. And that shows the connection between an actor and a character. It's an amazing moment. Other favorites of mine of Nimoy playing Spock would be, I just love This Side of Paradise. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of my favorite episodes. I'm surprised when I look at top 10 lists that it's not always up there. Matter of fact, I don't think it's ever in the top 10 list that I see from various people. It would have to be in my top 10 list. It's just such a fantastic episode for Spock, for Kirk being alone on the Enterprise with his crew having abandoned ship. With the fact that he's so driven by ambition that he can overcome the spores and snap out of it. And then what he has to do to Spock to make him snap out of it. And that amazingly poignant line at the end when Spock says to him, for the first time in my life, I was happy. Mm-hmm. God, it's powerful stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those performances where Leonard Nimoy was able to explore the emotional side of Spock, they're really interesting moments on that series, because it really, as we sort of talked about earlier in our discussion here, is it really informed how everybody else would play a Vulcan down the line.
Yeah. You know, I just finished the third book, or it just came out. I finished it back last fall. But, you know, so the third season episodes were the last ones I'd watched during this writing process. So a lot of them are sticking in my mind, like, is there in truth no beauty? I just think that's a fantastic moment when he and Carlos combine and he experiences, I love that line by McCoy, with, that's not Spock. He says, why, are you surprised I read Byron? That's Spock. You know? and the whole thing. But then he says that thing about, you are so lonely in these bodies. You're so isolated and you depend on this language, which is so insignificant for what you want to try to communicate. And it, my God, it's powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's the bad season, and All Our Yesterdays with the stuff with Mariette Hartley. But two of them from that year, which I never really noticed when I was younger, but as a wiser and more sensitive adult, you know, I just really tuned into it as I was watching these episodes. One was The Empath, and the other was For the World Is Hollow and I Touched the Sky, and both of them have these little moments where McCoy is sick. And Spock puts a hand down and kind of cradles his head, a very subtle move. And McCoy looks at the hand and looks up at Spock. And Kirk says, he knows, Doctor. That's from For the World Is Hollow and I Touched the Sky. What a magnificent moment. But these two characters who are always sparring, and one of them coughs and Spock reaches down and cradles his head. And just that look between the two is a powerful moment. And I love the fact that comes from a so-so episode in the worst season, but it's still a great moment. And that's Star Trek, even at its worst, it was great because you had these fantastic actors and you had these fantastic characters for them to play.
Yeah. And that's really where the character ends on the page and starts in a performance, and how important that is. And you know, you mentioned Martin Landau, and we might not be sitting here right now talking about Star Trek had he gone on to play that role.
Not at all. Or if Jack Lord had played Kirk, like they almost had him. Imagine that, Jack Lord and Martin Landau. And Martin Landau is a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
I've met him a few times. I wrote a script once that he was going to be cast in, and he was very kind to me, very gracious. I've always admired him. I loved him in the Ed Wood movie. Mm-hmm. But so many things. North by Northwest, Nevada Smith. Boy, he played a stinker in that one. You know, just a great actor. A couple of his Outer Limits. Mm-hmm. The one where the man that time forgot, I think it was called, where he goes back to Earth to kill the person who's going to have the child that's going to destroy Earth.
Right.
Neat script, neat and terrific performance. But no, he would not have connected with that character. No offense to Mr. Landau, and no offense to Jack Lord, who was perfect as Steve McGarrett, but would not have been a Kirk. No, lightning struck twice, three times with DeForest Kelly, four times with James Doohan. I mean, it's just Star Trek is still around 49 years later this September and 50 years next year. It's still around because something magical happened with Star Trek. When you look at the casting and try to imagine anybody else in those key roles and anybody else behind the typewriter other than Gene Roddenberry and Gene Kuhn and Dorothy Fontana and anybody else writing memos, as you see in my books, other than Bob Justman, my God, his contributions were way more than we had ever realized.
Yeah.
I mean, you just had this amazing pool of talent that somehow came in the same door at the same time, almost by divine intervention.
Yeah, and against a lot of odds, too. We were talking on our first tribute episode about how amazing it is that Star Trek lasted for three seasons in prime time when it was really a series that was driven for lack of a better word, you know, the geeks of the world.
Yeah, it's, you know, I got to tell you, I'm writing a book now for the 50th anniversary of Lost in Space, which will be out this September. I'm kind of looking at it the way I do with Star Trek, but it's going to be one book, not three, because it's Lost in Space. It's not Star Trek. And I love Lost in Space, and I'm not afraid to admit it. I mean, I was watching Lost in Space when I was 9 years old, a year before Star Trek premiered on NBC, and it was the first show of its type on TV, and it just really was like, my God, this is great. They're in space every week, and it's a family and everything. And that first year of black and white episodes, I think, was pretty good. And the color ones are pretty imaginative and pretty wild, but you know, I'm looking at those episodes and I'm reading the scripts and I'm going through the memos and all the things that I did when I did the Star Trek books. And it's so clear why Star Trek is Star Trek. Because, you know, when you look at those memos in my books, you know, they cared so much every episode. Even the ones that weren't quite coming together for whatever reason, they were still giving it 100%. They were trying as good as they could do to get it to be as good as it could be. Knowing that we have to deliver the script in 3 days and we have to deliver the episode in 6 days and we have to get on to the next one and we're just going to have to, you know, let this one go. But they were still giving it everything they could. And I'm reading the memos for Lost in Space and I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing talented people and clever people and fun ideas and great effects. I mean, Irwin Allen certainly knew how to do the effects.
Oh, sure.
But I don't see any memos talking about theme. You know, what we're trying to say with these characters or inconsistencies in the characters, which you see in the Star Trek memos constantly.
Right.
With Bob Justman being a watchdog. I'm not seeing any letters from the cast like the letters that you see in my books that Leonard Nimoy wrote and sent into Gene Roddenberry about Spock. And I really like this script or I have a problem with that script or I'm not going to do this scene the way you wrote it. Not to be difficult, but come on, this is not right. And, you know, and him coming up with the nerve pinch and Roddenberry writes him a letter kind of slapping his hand and saying, well, don't do that again, but we're going to go with it. That one works, but it's not good manners to be rewriting the stuff on the set without us knowing about it. But I'm not seeing any of that on that show. I'm seeing disgruntled actors saying the show's changing, it's getting too campy, they're not giving us enough to do, but they're not really fighting for their roles the way Shatner did and the way Nimoy did. They're not really contributing the ideas. And so it's a difference, you know, and I like it. It's a good show for me. But there's a reason why Star Trek is a great show and a reason why we're all going to be celebrating the 50th next year, because they really put in the extra hours. They put in the extra energy. They put in the extra thought. They care that much.
Totally.
They put their lives on hold, and they gave everything to that show.
Absolutely.
No, right on. Moving past Star Trek for a minute, are there any points or aspects of Leonard Nimoy's career outside of Star Trek that really sort of resonate with you?
I thought he was very smart to jump right into Mission Impossible because he knew, you know, first of all, he got nominated for an Emmy every year Star Trek was on, and that was amazing, the achievement. Science fiction had not been acknowledged by the Emmys. The only sci-fi show that had gotten any acknowledgement was Twilight Zone, and that was just for scripts because it was Rod Serling, and he had already won a couple Emmys when he went into Twilight Zone.
Right.
Outer Limits got one nomination for a technical award. And Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea maybe got something for a technical award. Didn't win, but got a nomination. But every year Star Trek was on, it got nominated for Best Dramatic Series, and Nimoy got nominated for Best Actor in a Supporting Role. So they could not ignore how good this show was for its time. And to come out of that, getting as much fan mail as he was getting and be acknowledged as greatly as he was, how do you survive that and get back to an acting career where you can play other characters when you're that closely identified with this Spock? And so he went straight into Mission Impossible where he could play a master of disguises, taking over the Martin Landau role. So that's the second time he got a part because Martin Landau stepped away. And it was just a brilliant move on his part because every week for 2 years on CBS, you're seeing Leonard Nimoy wearing fake mustaches and eyebrows and glasses and playing these different dialects and everything. So it was able to jumpstart his career again. But what he did that I think was really special, I watched it not too long ago as I was researching a fourth book on Star Trek for the 50th next year for Star Trek, which will finish up all the business on TOS, the animated series, phase two, the movies and all that. Anyway, so I'm watching some of his solo stuff that he did, and he did a stage play, a one-man stage performance on Van Gogh, reading letters, playing Van Gogh's brother and reading letters that he and Van Gogh had written back and forth to each other, real letters. And Nimoy wrote it, not the letters, but he wrote the wraparound material, wrote the play. He directed it, and he starred in it, and they filmed it. You can get it on DVD. You can rent it through Netflix.
Oh, wow.
And it's just look up Van Gogh, Leonard Nimoy. And it's really very moving, and it's a really special thing. It's just Nimoy for an hour and a half playing Van Gogh's brother, talking about this tortured artist who was too fragile to live but wanting to mark his life. And you see how he throws himself into that performance and into that production and all the technical stuff that he does where he's working in the pictures of Van Gogh that are screening up on the wall as he's doing the dialogue. And it's really, for the mid, late 1970s, it was really a marvel that he did this thing. I was really impressed. So I highly recommend that. They probably got one copy, which means – Craig or Jeff, you guys can get it tonight, and not everybody else will have to wait until you're done with it.
We're going to be rushing over to and race to get that. You know, Mark, something that stuck out to me earlier on in this episode, and we were asking you about your favorite Spock moments from the original series, and you immediately brought up The Devil in the Dark, and it kind of threw me for a loop because in a previous conversation with some other guests, we were talking about favorite Spock moments, and that was the episode that I had gone to for one of my favorite Spock moments. But we picked different moments, which kind of stuck out to me as a kind of a testament to you know, Star Trek as a whole and how Nimoy's portrayal of that character could mean different things to different people. And the moment that I honed in on was, you know, we'd been watching this episode for a little while, and it was, you know, Spock in his typical Vulcan mode and analyzing things and trying to figure out what they were dealing with. But he gets to a point where he and Kirk are looking for the monster and that they're separated, and he finds out that Kirk is in the same room with the monster, and all of a sudden the Vulcan veil drops and you see the human side come out of him and the concern comes out of him. And I thought it was amazing that he could transform that quickly, you know, with no physical transformation, but just the change in his demeanor could portray that to the audience.
Yeah, and he doesn't say captain. He says Jim.
Yes.
Jim, get out of there. Yeah. Jim, you're in danger. Get out of there. And when Kirk says no, then well, I'm on my way. I'll be right there. You know, that's something is one of the things about the character of Spock and Nimoy's portrayal as the character is he's the great friend. He's the guy we would all want at our side
yeah.
if we were a James Kirk, or no matter who we are. I mean, first of all, he knows everything. He's like having a computer that has all the information of the universe in it, that you can ask him any question and get the information. You don't have to pull out your smartphone or anything else. You got your smart Spock. But he's loyal. Now, he may be looking at you with a lot of curiosity and thinking that you're kind of an imperfect human, but the thing is he's so loyal. I mean, he, you know, he was – Kirk, he was Batman's Robin to Kirk, but so much better. You know, he's just going to always be with Kirk. And, you know, the first movie didn't really make this clear. I read the novelization that Gene Roddenberry wrote for the first movie, and he makes it very clear in the book that when Spock is on Vulcan, going through his steps of this program that he's doing, he's kind of stops and looks off, and that's when they say, no, your calling lies elsewhere. It's because he gets a calling from Kirk. He picks up on Kirk's psychic signal that Kirk needs him. That Kirk is thinking, God, how am I going to do what I got to do without Spock by my side?
Wow.
You know, I haven't sat in a command chair for 5 years. It's a new enterprise. This thing's coming. I got to go somehow do the magic that I always used to do. And what if my luck's run out? And I never had any success without Spock by my side, and he's not going to be there. And there's a little moment in the book where you see Kirk thinking that, and then it cuts over to Vulcan, and Spock is in those final moments, and he picks up on that. And that's when he knows he has to reconnect with Kirk. So even though it was understated in the movie, it's clear in the book, but it's not so clear in the movie. But nonetheless, it's clear to us that that's that character. And, you know, when William Shatner said the other day after Leonard Nimoy passed away that I loved him like a brother, I believe it.
Yeah.
I'm sure they fought like brothers. They didn't always get along like brothers. But I really believe that he loved Leonard Nimoy like a brother. And I believe Leonard Nimoy had great affection for William Shatner, too, because like Spock, I think Nimoy was a very loyal person. I came across an amazing story in research for the fourth book. And when they did the animated series, there's a lot of interesting stories why they did the animated series, by the way, but you'll have to wait. But I'll tell you this one. They only signed Shatner, Nimoy, Jimmy Doohan, DeForest Kelly, and Majel. They did not sign George Takei or Walter or Michelle. And Filmation said, we don't have enough money to get them in here, so we're going to do their likenesses, and we're going to have Jimmy Doohan do the voices of the two guys, and we're going to have Majel do the voice of Nichelle Nichols, wow. of your hero. And Nimoy found out about that, and he said, no. He said, you're not going to use their likeness, and wow. you're not going to have somebody imitate their voices. Either they're in, or I'm out.
Wow.
How often does an actor put his head on a chopping block like that? Because, see, you're not just jeopardizing getting a part, but you're jeopardizing getting a bad reputation in the industry.
Right.
And he did that for them, and they know it. I've talked to Walter Koenig about it. I talked to Michelle about it. They're very aware of it and so grateful to him. I talked to Grace Lee Whitney, who was so grateful to Leonard, because he was so supportive of her at the time that she was taken out of the show, and he was so there for her. And that is Spock. You know, Spock didn't understand our emotions, but he was patient with us, and he stood by us. And that was Leonard Nimoy.
Right on. That was a lot of information to take in there. And is there anything you want to speak to just in general about Leonard Nimoy and what he means to you before we wrap up?
Oh boy. I, you know, I had never met Leonard. When I was trying to interview him for the first book, I had my agent contact his agent, and they sent back a very polite, saying no, and told me why. So I found all the archival interviews and plugged his voice in, all that bit. And I teach screenwriting over at Pierce College. And I got home. It was a day, weird day, because I had to go over to CBS to do an interview for a box set for Next Generation. They were doing a thing on Gene Roddenberry, and they wanted to interview me for that. And so I was over taping that thing, and I came home, and there was a message from Pierce to call them. And I called them up, and they said, look, you know, we don't, as you know, we don't give out the phone numbers for our instructors, but somebody is trying to reach you. And he says he's Leonard Nimoy, and we don't know if it's the Leonard Nimoy, but we thought, you know, he gave us this number, and you know, they gave me the number. I knew it was the right area code. And I call up, and he answers. Or no, his wife answers. His wife answers. I says, is Leonard there? Just a minute. And he comes on the phone. It was just you didn't even have to ask. You know, I didn't say, is this the Leonard anymore? You just knew it was. I said, hi, Leonard. It's Mark Cushman. And he just was so gracious. He said, Mark, this book, I just read it. The research is astounding, and on and on. And he was just complimenting me on the book, and he said, you know, but there's a couple things in here that I think you could have used maybe some information. I said, well, I did try to reach you. And he says, I know. And he says, well, let me give it to you now. And I said, fine, you know, because I had asked them to redo the first book. I didn't like the cover, and they didn't do a very good job proofing it. And I said, yeah, can we get this cleaned up for the second print run? So I called them up and said, can we add in some stuff from him? And they said, sure. And they had it for the other books too. But you know, that he tracked me down, you know, we never met, but I guess he read on the back of the book that I taught at Pierce. So he calls Pierce trying to find me. Here's Spock.
Wow.
You know, using his logic, doing research as Spock would do it. And he's tracking me down to give me his praise on the book and then make himself available to give me additional information. And the information he gave me, this is really important. In the book, the first version of the first book, you know, I credited the making of the Spock ears to John Chambers. And because I've got quotes from John Chambers saying, you know, that he did it. And I got quotes from other people saying that he did it. And Leonard says, no, John Chambers worked on them. He was there. He was one of the people who would make the ears over the course of the series. But he primarily worked on Lost in Space at that time, and then did the Planet of the Apes movies and so on. He said, but he's not the guy who came up with it. And Fred Phillips was the guy who brought me to the person who came up with it. It was a makeup artist over at MGM. And so he starts telling me the story, and it was important to him that the right people get the credit. This had nothing to do with him, Leonard, taking credit for anything. And he just wanted me to get it in print because he liked the book, and he said, this is a good book, it's valid, it's the definitive book, in my opinion, so I want it to have all the right information in it, so let's get this guy's name in there, too, if there's any way to do it. Wow. And this guy's long dead, but that was just important to him. Wow. To track me down and to give this guy the tribute for being the one that came up with the ears. I can't remember his name, but it's in the revised book. In one of the early chapters, there's a whole big section of Nimoy telling this story. And he was an old MGM makeup guy that went all the way back to The Wizard of Oz that Fred Phillips had worked for when he was a young man working on Wizard of Oz, and that's where he knew him from. And he was the guy who came up with the whole design and cooked up the first ears, and then after that, Fred Phillips would cook them up every night so they had a fresh pair of ears. And I'd say cook them literally in the oven for hours and then take them out and let them cool so he could take them in the morning and put them on Nimoy at 6:30 in the morning every day.
Wow.
But I just, you know, was so struck by his integrity that he wanted to express his appreciation to me, but he also wanted to this guy to get credit for the years, and then finding out what he did for Walter and George and Michelle and on and on. You know, that's the guy I'm going to miss. You know, it's not like I feel like I know him deeply because of all the research and going through all the archival interviews and then talking to him and talking to his son and on and on. But really, we were just passing ships in the night. But I feel like I've lost a member of my extended family, as I'm sure you guys do, as I'm sure millions of people do.
Yeah.
But, you know, the wonderful thing is we haven't lost him. You know, we've got him in all those episodes. We've got him in his books. We've got all that he's contributed, even his appearance in the newer movies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he lives on in all of us. I guess we better live long lives and we better prosper because he lives on in us.
Yeah.
Well said, Mark. And I think Leonard's desire to be involved with your books after reading that first printing of that first volume really speaks to the quality of work you did and also showcases how important your books are. And people might not have thought about that, but you really were able to capture stories directly from the people who lived it at a time when we're starting to lose these people.
Yeah, I know. It's hurts every time we lose one. I mean, I interviewed William Wyndham and he passed away. I interviewed Malachi Throne and he passed away. And, you know, just so many people I've interviewed just in the last 5 years, several years, and we're losing them one by one. Arlene Martel, who was a friend of mine, and I was taking care of her little dog for her when she was in the hospital. And then we lost her so unexpectedly because she was in really good health and so young.
Yeah.
And looked great and acted great and had lots of energy, but she got an infection after a surgery and that did it.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the people who were already gone, I would go back and find interviews and try to find interviews that were done when the show was actually being produced, when their memories were fresh and the excitement is in their voices as they're there doing it. So I tried to do that with everybody who was on the crew, as well as the cast, as well as the writers, directors, as well as key members of the audience, people who were working to save Star Trek and part of the protests that was going on, and got their voices in there. So it's really, they're all telling their story, you know, all their separate stories that combine together and make Star Trek a living, breathing entity. And that's why I call these books a biography of a TV series. It's a biography on all the people that made this TV series during the time that they were working together. And it's an amazing story. It was supposed to be one book, but the more I researched, the more I interviewed, the more Bob Justman memos I came across. And I love those memos. I mean, Jesus, it's like I could just sit down and read an entire book of Bob Justman memos and be entertained all night. He's so funny and he's so enlightening. You know, and everything he says, what a brilliant man. And he invited me into his home graciously on half a dozen different occasions to interview him and gave me stuff. I interviewed Roddenberry, of course, way back in the 80s for this. And so it's been a lot of years in the making and captured a lot of voices. Dorothy Fontana, I think 4 different interviews with her alone. She was so contributed so much. And John D.F. Black, all of them. So, yeah, they deserve their moment because I'll tell you one quick story, if I may.
Oh, sure. Of course.
About John D.F. Black. You know, he left the show halfway into the first season because he didn't want to burn out like everybody else. He was working until 2 a.m. rewriting scripts, and he and Gene were rewriting all the scripts. And John was there from the beginning, not the pilots, but the beginning of the first episode, the Corbinite Maneuver. And John and Gene wrote the opening narration together. John was the one who came up with the line "Space, the final frontier." You know, so you know he was there. He was a big part of Star Trek, but he left when they were about at episode 14 or so, and hasn't really been involved with it since. He did come back and do an episode for Next Generation, but other than that, he's been kind of distant from it. And he and Gene had a bit of a falling out, so. He just really didn't participate in any of the celebration of Star Trek. But he did write the foreword for book one, and he did come out with me to some book signings. And he was so touched because, you know, this guy had done work for so many series, you know, Hawaii 5-0 and Charlie's Angels and on and on and on. You know, he wrote the first Shaft movie. He'd done so much work. And these people are coming up to him and telling him how much they appreciate his work and quoting lines out of The Naked Time and everything. And this one guy, he had tears in his eyes this one day because this guy came up in a wheelchair and had knew that John had written the first draft for The Menagerie with the crippled Captain Pike, even though he didn't get a screen credit. He did the first draft of that, and then Gene rewrote him. And this guy came out, he probably read it in my book, as I probably knew. But he came up to John and shook his hand, and he said, "That episode when I was a kid and I knew I was never going to walk, that episode taught me something about the dignity of man, and that, that this guy, this poor man who was crippled and in a wheelchair, still was a man. That speech McCoy makes about he has the same dreams we have and the same aspirations we have, and the respect that Spock showed to him, and the fact that Spock was willing to put his career on line for him to get him, you know, where he needed to be. And this guy said that that episode was just so important to him, and it helped him with his own situation. And he left afterwards, and I looked over at John, and John was just speechless. He was just sitting there, and his eyes were kind of teary, and it meant so much to him. And I'm just so happy that John was able to come back in and experience what Star Trek has become after kind of being on the outside and not being aware of it for so many decades.
Right, right.
Wow. That's always a thrill.
Well, Mark, we want to thank you for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to pay tribute to Leonard Nimoy and give some of your thoughts about the great man that we lost. And it's always an honor and a privilege to speak with you, and we look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks a lot, guys. And then the last thing I'll say about Leonard is he's immortal, isn't he?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, he's with us, and he knew that. You know, he was able to see the success of Star Trek. He knew. I loved reading his tweets. I love that tweet he sent out a few days before he passed.
Yes. Oh wow, about the garden.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this man was he was ready. He mm-hmm. wasn't afraid, from what I can sense. I had breakfast with his son Adam just a few days before he passed, and Adam had met with him that morning and was coming to see me, and you know, I don't. You know, he was a very brave man, and he knew that he had had an amazing, successful life, that he had lived long and he had prospered, yeah. that he had created this character that we all love, and it's going to keep living and keep walking on the earth. What a wonderful thing to know.
Yeah,
for any of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Very well said, Mark.
Yeah, I hope when I die, I know that you guys are still walking my books around. Okay, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next up, our two first ever guests on this show. Our first supplemental log episode happened way, 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 way back early on in the series, well over a year ago. And that was an episode dedicated to Star Trek The Experience, the former Star Trek exhibit and ride and bar and gift shop and museum in Las Vegas. And two former actors from Star Trek The Experience appeared on this show, and then we've become fast friends with them, and we've seen them several times, and we look forward to seeing them again at the convention next year, and that's April A. Bear and Vernon Wilmer. Guys, it's an unfortunate, somber occasion that we've gotten together today, and that is to commemorate the passing last Friday of Leonard Nimoy, and it's been a very sad occasion for all Trek fans and even some non-Trek fans out there. And we wanted to sit down with some of our regular guests and get their thoughts and perspectives on Leonard and the effect that Leonard had and Spock had on their lives. So we immediately thought of the two of you.
Oh, well, I have to say that it did make a big impact on me. Should I tell you how I found out? Because it was a little traumatic.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, well, my daughter and I were going to Disneyland for Dapper Day. You should look at that. Dapper Day is awesome. So we're driving down the 15 south to, on the road to L.A. And so we're about halfway there, and my daughter had her Facebook page open, and she's looking through it, and she just off the top of her head said, "Oh, Leonard Nimoy died."
Oh,
and
no.
I'm driving, and I burst into tears. I'm like, "Oh my God." And I couldn't see because my eyes filled immediately with tears.
Oh.
And I'm trying to keep, you know, my hands on the wheel, and she was like, "Oh my God, Mom, are you okay? Don't crash the car. Don't crash the car." And it's like, "No, I'm okay. I'll be okay." It was very traumatic because I had heard that he was in the hospital, and you know, I understood that he had COPD and he's 83 years old, and you know, that stuff did register with me, but that was like such a shock to my system. And then about 20 minutes later, you know, I recovered, but I had tears in my eyes, and she was apologizing. I'm so sorry. I didn't know it would affect you like this. How could she not know that? But anyway, she didn't. So we drove into Baker, which is a little town on the way, you know, to Disneyland on the I-15, and pulled off the road and went to the Alien Beef Jerky store. That is a bit, anybody who goes to Baker needs to go to the Alien Beef Jerky
store.
That's
a real thing.
It is a total thing. Wow. And it's great. So we went in there and we started looking at stuff, and I went past where all, you know, all the products were. I was looking for the ladies' room so I could like wash my face and dry my eyes. And what do I see on the wall but Spock and McCoy, you know, the big cutouts of them. And so, of course, I broke into tears again. And I went and got Erica and I said, you have to take a picture of me with Spock and McCoy. So she did. And so I got to say my goodbyes to Spock. And, you know, of course, McCoy was there as well. But I thought it was really sad that they were relegated to the back of the store. Maybe they're not there now. Maybe they pulled them out because of, you know, Leonard Nimoy's passing. But it was so weird, you know, that I am sobbing because a person that meant so much to me had passed. And then there he is at the Alien Beef Jerky store. So that was my, you know, coming to terms with his passing. But I did, when I saw Spock there, it made me feel a little bit better, because I realized that, you know, of course, the man has passed, but that character, that thing that he created, will live forever. So,
and it's everywhere. Everywhere.
Yes. Yeah.
It is. Well, that's what an incredible coincidence that the store that you happened to stop at on your way to Disneyland, there happened to be a Spock cutout there.
I know, it was amazing.
Well, it was probably meant to be, if you believe in destiny and things like that. That sounds like it's something that was meant to occur.
Well, I believe in coincidences.
Okay, well, it's close enough. Close enough.
Yeah.
So, Vernon, do you recall how you learned of this?
Oh yeah, I was driving to work. I was in the left turn lane at Desert Inn and Paradise when I got a text from Dan Wright, who is a friend of Star Trek The Experience and a big Star Trek fan, very nice kid from Tennessee. Mm. And, you know, he knows I'm busy during the workday, so he didn't bother me too much. He just simply wrote, Mr. Nimoy has died with a sad face. Mm. And I'd heard Mr. Nimoy had been in the hospital a few days before that. So it didn't come as a shock to me. And I can't say I reacted the same way as April, because I'm used to people aging and passing on. I've experienced it a lot in my life. I may have shed 1.5 tears between that intersection and getting to work. And thought to myself, how am I going to deal with this in my life? Because every time an iconic figure in your life dies, you feel older. Mm-hmm. And something you know of out there is gone now.
That's a great point.
And he's a wonderful person. And I thought, well, if this great body of work exists that you can always go back to and revisit, you'll never see him in person again. But how often do I do that anymore? I've met him a few times during the course of my life, mostly conventions, of course, and the time he appeared at Star Trek The Experience. And I ran into him in a bookstore in Santa Monica once by accident. So he signed a CD for me.
Oh, wow. That's so awesome.
That was pretty cool. But the worst part about it is I get to work and, you know, they call me the Star Trek guy there because I'm always going on about how I acted at the experience in the live show. My phone is a functioning communicator. You know, people are always making fun of me, but, you know, in a joking adult getting along sort of way. But they all start in with, oh, I thought you'd take the day off because Spock died and you'd be in mourning. And, you know, I don't respond to any of these people, but my thought is Spock didn't die. That's a character. Mm. A wonderful man named Leonard Nimoy has died. Show some respect. Shut your McDonald's hole. Man was an actor, an artist. He lived a long, full life. He contributed a lot to society. Nobody in the world has ever had or will ever have a voice like his.
That's true.
And so I had to keep, you know, I was grieving, but I was grieving inwardly, but these jerks at my job were not making that easy. Well, and it's been that way all week. It's been that way all week at work.
You know, I have to say that the people that, you know, I work with or that I'm friends with on Facebook and social media, I got all kinds of texts from people like, are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you okay? Are you going to be all right? And this is a person who I'm not related to, you know, but the people out there who knew what Star Trek means to me were concerned about me. And that, I think, more than even the knowledge that he had passed, made me feel so, it really helped get through it, you know? I mean, because here are people who know what it means to me that we're concerned about my well-being, you know? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. My colleagues at the college were texting me, are you going to be all right? We just heard. Which shows you that they know me. They know, you know, what's important to me, but they also are concerned about me. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. And, you know, I think for the sake of our audience, in case there's anybody who is tuning into this episode who is not familiar with the characters that you guys portrayed. April, you did portray a Vulcan character at the experience. That would be T'Pril.
Yes, Professor T'Pril. And I mean, so much of how I made my living and, you know, what I did for so long was based on what Leonard Nimoy did. I didn't try to be his character. That's not what you do when you're an environmental interactive theater actor, you know? I mean, you try to create a unique individual character, but you use all the body of knowledge that you have to do that. And because of Leonard Nimoy and all the stuff that came from that, the Star Trek universe, I had so much information to pull from to create that individual unique person, you know, who was Professor T'Pril. And that was largely due to all the things that Nimoy did.
He created so much of that character himself, and as well as the entire society, of the race of Vulcan. It was nice that they let him have that input.
You know, one thing, speaking of Nimoy creating the Spock character and Vulcans in general, a thought that we had come up with on a brief Nimoy tribute episode that we did this past weekend, and I this is something that resonates in my head, is that Spock's father, Sarek, was in a way created by Nimoy's portrayal of Spock, which I think from a character perspective is a pretty cool thought.
Right. I mean, I'm sure the writers, everybody had input into that, mm-hmm. You know, the writers and looking at what Nimoy had done with his character, you know, came up with that whole thing. So, yes, I have no doubt. And because of that, the whole idea of, you know, what Vulcan interaction family life is like, you know?
And they couldn't have picked a better actor to play Sarek.
No.
Absolutely couldn't. Nobody else could have done that.
Yeah, Mark Leonard was pretty incredible.
He was a great actor.
You know, he's passed on, James Doohan has passed on, D. Kelly has passed on. I don't remember this kind of upheaval going on.
Well, we didn't, I think we didn't have social media when all those people passed. I think that had we had the same interaction with each other that we had, you know, now that 15 years ago, that I think that it would have been, if not equal, at least somewhat the same. But now we have the ability to immediately interact with people who share our feelings. And so I think that I have never seen such an outpouring of sadness and love and remembrance as, you know, from anybody passing as I have with Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
It's absolutely incredible. In fact, you know, you April, you were mentioning earlier how you were getting text messages and IMs from friends. And I remember later the day in that day, you know, maybe in the early evening, I had gotten a text message from a friend of mine who is not a Star Trek fan, But, you know, she sent a message saying, you know, are you okay? How are you doing with it? I'm sorry for your loss. And I said, wow, you know, I know that you're not a Star Trek fan. And she said, well, you know, I know, you know, how important he was not only to you, but I know that he had a lot of contributions outside of Star Trek, you know, to the world in general, society in general. And it was pretty amazing to me that non-Star Trek fans or people who are decidedly non-Star Trek fans also kind of felt a ripple.
Yes, a ripple. That's cool.
Certainly.
Yes, I agree. I mean, he was certainly an amazing artist.
Larger than life.
Oh, he did some amazing things, you know, with art, with photography. He was a wonderful photographer. And all the other acting gigs that he did, I have to say, I really loved him in Fringe. When he would show up in Fringe, it would be like Christmas to me.
Combat, Mission Impossible.
Yeah. In Search Of. Hello.
I grew up on In Search Of. That's what kind of gave me this this kind of closet fandom.
Is that a thing?
Of you know, paranormal stuff on TV.
Oh, yeah.
I don't take any of it seriously, but no. God damn it, it's fun to watch. But you never have a better voice on a paranormal show than Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, that is absolutely true.
So, Vernon, shifting over to you for a minute, and I don't want to retread anything that we've tread over in prior episodes, but I was curious, knowing that you're opinions on the two newest Trek movies, do you have a different take on those films now, or at least a slightly different sentiment towards them, knowing that those were the last portrayals of the Spock character?
Nope. The only thing that came to mind was, oh my God, what are they going to do to legitimize the third film? Because they don't have the man this time. They're on their own. Can they get Shatner to do a cameo to give it some legitimacy? Maybe.
Well, let's shift away from that topic then. And so you spoke about, Vernon, you spoke about meeting Leonard Nimoy several times. Do you have any particular fond memories of any of those times that you want to share?
I'd seen him at conventions when I was a kid a lot. I couldn't even tell you the first time, maybe 1984. I remember paying a lot of attention to him at a 1986 convention when Star Trek IV was out, and kind of following him around, Mr. Nimoy. That was back when you could approach these people, and the conventions weren't these giant, commercial, impossible things. But the coolest time was, like I mentioned before, I'm at the promenade in Santa Monica with some friends one day. We go into the bookstore. I'm going up the stairs, and Nimoy's coming down the stairs with a couple of his cronies. They were there for some kind of CD signing. In fact, it was Alien Voices. So I very quickly grabbed one of those and asked him to autograph it for me. He was very nice and cordial and had a cover. Apparently, there was something lined up that day. I just beat everybody to it. They all stood in line for autographs and all this. I just kind of met up with him and said, hey! And he was like, oh, yeah. Probably thought I was there for that. But that was the most personable time. That's the one that stands out the most.
Now, you also mentioned that he was at the Star Trek Experience. Do either of you have any recollection of that?
Actually, he came through before we opened, and it was on my one day off in about a month. We were doing like 12-hour days, you know, just making sure everything was up and running and running the show and, you know, with the original show crew. And that's when a large majority of the stars came through. And the one day that I was like, I need to not be here because I can't see straight. And they said, okay, go home. Yeah, the next, I came back and they're like, oh yeah, Nimoy was here. I was just.
What did you learn?
Never take a day off.
Yeah, not at Star Trek The Experience.
Yeah, right. So that would have been my chance to get up close and personal with him, but that did not happen. And then he came through later as part of the 40th anniversary.
In 2006, he and Shatner came to the funnily enough, they used the Borg invasion to film their segments, quick, brief interview segments for the 40th anniversary. They the producers probably thought, well, it's some kind of Star Trek background, so we'll just go backstage here and do this. You know, between shows, we weren't doing anything. But I'm going up. I see a green light on the stage, so I'm going back there, and there's a camera crew, and there's Nimoy, and I'm like, oh, nobody told me there's something going on back here. So I got to kind of hang back and peek and eavesdrop while they were doing the interview. And then, of course, I have clips of it on the computer. They used very little of it. But Shatner, they sat him in the Olympia in the pilot seat. And then they did this beam out. And it was cute. It was neat seeing them there because they are the, you know, to us, the Star Trek gods. You know, if DeForest Kelly had been there with him, it would have been perfect. But he had passed, of course.
Right. Well, I didn't see Nimoy at all. I only saw Shatner. And that was just because he would go behind me when I was putting my makeup on that particular day, and he was going back and forth behind me, and I don't interact with somebody unless they want me to, so I just didn't interact with him. But I didn't even see Nimoy at all, so I have never seen him up close and personal. I mean, I went to the one convention, I think that was it 2 years ago,
when he was riding around his little scooter. That was like 2011.
Well, yeah, when he did his farewell panel at Star Trek The Experience, at the Star Trek convention that year. And he said, this is the last one. So I went to it, and it was great. I mean, this huge auditorium was filled with about, I would say, 2,500 people. I mean, it was packed. But I was there for that. So I never got to talk to him or interact with him in that way. But of course he like informs every aspect of my life, you know, regardless of that.
So we've been talking a lot about Leonard Nimoy, the man, and meeting him and seeing him. But I was also wondering, you know, you guys have a long Trek history, and especially Vernon has a very deep knowledge of all of the series, but I was wondering if you guys had any standout Spock character moments that you're particularly fond of from either the original series or the films that followed. So Vernon, do you have anything that comes to mind?
The one that stands out the most is after the character of Spock has been through death and life, and then learning to be not only himself again, but they did this very well throughout the course of the movies, find his balance between being Vulcan and being human, which he ultimately does. My favorite delivery is in Star Trek IV, when he insists they go help Chekhov because it's the human thing to do. It was a perfectly acted moment, and the interaction with the other characters was perfect. I thought that was the peak of the Spock arc, of his character throughout the series and movies.
Wow, that's, you know, it's very interesting you brought that up. And if you think about that moment juxtaposed with the Spock from, say, the Galileo 7, you can really see how much the character grew, right?
Absolutely. He did a great job with that.
Fantastic moment. That very good. I hadn't thought of that one. I had thought about a bunch of my own moments that I wanted to bring up, but that's a really good one. April, anything jump to mind for you?
Well, you know, as a young girl, I saw the original series on a tiny little television in my mom's bedroom. So I have to say that I was a Kirk girl, you know. But here's what I love, because I was at that preteen, you know, romantic age at that point when the original series first aired. And so when I would watch it, and Spock would get the girl occasionally, you know, and I was so happy for him.
Because Jill Ireland.
I know. He got some hotties. So, you know, and I'd be like, go Spock. That's so awesome. So, you know, for my preteen angst, that was good, because I connected with that, because I didn't feel particularly attractive at that age, you know? And so the idea that somebody who was smart, who was cerebral, could actually be attractive to the opposite sex, gave me hope for the future. So to me, that, you know, my youth, that's what I remembered. And then, you know, as an adult, I think the death scene with Spock and Kirk,
yeah,
in The Wrath of Khan is possibly the most emotion-laden scene in all of Trek. I can't imagine another one that has more intensity to it.
It's incredible.
It is. It is because of the level. Okay, now I'm crying.
Oh. And JJ saw it and said, "Hey, we'll try to do that too. We'll take it and reverse it the other way.
Yeah,
it'll be great."
Here's the deal. I don't think you could ever. I don't think had they done it the same way, it would have been the same. You can't. That was a singular moment in movie history.
Yes.
You know? And because it had everything going for it, it had love, it had death, it had longing, you know, the longing of Kirk to be with his friend and not be able to help him and mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Yep.
You know, every possible emotion was in that scene. And to me, that's the epitome of, well, it's the epitome of drama and theater. You know, that's what we do.
It's also about life. That movie is about facing death.
Yes, it is about facing death, which, you know, we all have to do. It's never easy. So dealing with it.
My JJ is dead on, by the way. That's a dead
actually,
on.
You sounded a lot more like a flying squirrel to me, Vernon.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
You know, April, I'm glad that you brought up the death scene from Star Trek II, because that sparked a memory that I had as a small child when I saw Wrath of Khan in the movie theaters. And this was, you know, long before the internet ever existed. But prior to that movie coming out, I remember very distinctly, I was already a little young Trekkie. I remember that there were rumors that were published in sci-fi magazines that Spock was going to die.
Right.
In the movie, and when they decided to do the Kobayashi Maru and kill off Spock in the beginning of the movie, that was a wonderful way to divert the audience away from that rumor that had been spreading around. And I remember when I was in the theater and I saw that moment and I saw Spock, quote unquote, die in that scene, I'm like, oh, that must be what the rumor was about. So when he actually did die at the end of the movie, it was actually still a surprise.
Well, yeah, the foreshadowing aspect of that is something that's very, that's done a lot in drama, in theater, you know, but it was done to very good effect in that.
The same thing happened. I was 12 years old and I thought, oh, that was the death? Okay. And then they made a joke out of it. You know, Shatner lightly says, "Aren't you dead?"
Yep,
and then they banter, and then you've got the movie. Okay, everything's fine. Now we can enjoy the rest of the film. And then the character of Spock, of course, dies, leaving my 12-year-old self going, "No, no, no, no." We recover from that in Star Trek III, and then they take the Enterprise away from us.
Another major character.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. The Enterprise is a...
They were really
the main character,
tugging on our heartstrings in those movies.
Yes.
They certainly were. They certainly were. I remember when the VHS era had begun and the movies had started to come out, and my aunt, my uncle was the guy that got me into Star Trek as a young kid, and my aunt was very anti-Star Trek, in fact, hated it. But when she learned that Spock died in Star Trek II, she became so interested that she decided she had to see these movies.
Oh, wow.
So that actually converted her into a Star Trek fan.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I would have never thought that. My mother, unfortunately, who's still anti-Star Trek, has never been converted over. But
no accounting for taste.
No, there isn't. But, you know, I had a couple of Spock moments that I wanted to throw out at you guys and see what your takes on them were from the original series. And a couple of them, one that stands out to me as a pretty a bold statement by Spock is in the menagerie, where, you know, we've gotten used to this, you know, this logical, cold guy who all of a sudden, you know, changes his tack and goes out on a limb, risks his entire career in order to help out his former captain, which seems like it'd be really out of character for Spock, wouldn't it? I mean, I thought that was a really incredible view into what Spock was capable of beyond that logical side.
I think that loyalty is a Vulcan virtue. I really do. So, but he also has a human half. So I think that the loyalty plus, you know, he's not completely Vulcan.
A lot of those acts of humanity, he immediately covers up at the end of the episode by saying it was the logical thing to do. And that's what he does at the end of Menagerie. And we accept that because him being half Vulcan and half human, him carrying out that human emotion of loyalty and sacrifice was the logical thing for his character to do.
Plus, we all know that despite the Vulcan exterior of calm, cool, unemotional, that Vulcans inside are raging volcanoes of emotion. So,
of course, that was also developed by Nimoy in the Spock character. So
absolutely.
We got to know that. And, you know, speaking of acts of humanity, you know, how about Operation Annihilate, where, you know, Spock risks himself to test this potential cure and winds up being blinded and, of course, getting his sight back. But, you know, Spock is willing to put himself in harm's way to potentially save all of the people on Deneva, right?
But the needs of the many, mm-hmm. you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. And I think that's how he kept that, you know, through everything he did.
So. I think he was counting on his inner eyelids to save him.
Well, that's
just
true.
He just wanted to look cooler by not mentioning it earlier.
Good point.
Hey, Vernon, do the inner eyelids come out in any other series after that?
Yes, Star Trek Enterprise, a three-part season four arc involving the Kirshara, where T'Pol has taken Archer into the forge. He asks her, hey, do you want sunglasses too? I've got sunglasses. Oh, no, we have this inner eyelid that protects us from the Vulcan sun. It was a nice there's a lot of Vulcan callbacks in that episode arc.
Yeah, they did that well.
Yeah, actually. Very well. There's even a sea lot in that episode.
That's right.
You know, Amok Time, of course, is a very popular Spock episode, but I think for me, the greatest Spock moment in that episode is at the very end when Spock is trying to turn himself in and learns that Kirk is still alive, and you see that big smile and the outburst of emotion when he actually sees Kirk. Yeah, I love that moment.
Well, again, it's totally true to the Vulcan nature, you know, which is highly emotional. And it slips out if they're not totally focused on maintaining, you know, and it does. And it's a perfect example of that.
Plus, there was so much writing on that moment. You can forgive a Vulcan for reacting like that.
True. April, did you have any calculated emotional outbursts as your Vulcan character at the experience?
Not calculated.
No, not calculated. But
little kid step on your foot.
No, nothing like that ever happened. I did have fellow actor friends who knew just how to push my buttons. I will say that. But I would manage to keep it under control. Despite that, most of the time when I would lose it, it would be because of Kirsten or Kastran. He knew totally how to mess with me, and he would.
Kirsten's got this deadpan look that you can just look at his face and laugh. And it, not because his face is funny looking, but because of the look he's giving you. And he's not even giving you one. That's his face at rest. So it's impossible not to laugh around this guy. And now, I know he always cracked you up, but did Quan crack you up during that neck pinch incident?
No. I totally walked away from that. Okay. There were some great incidents with other characters, but I managed to maintain while everybody else around me was laughing hysterically. So, no, I think that... because I had the outlet of Ta-Ryn, I had Commander Ta-Ryn as another outlet. So I was able to, you know, control myself as T'Pril because I knew that in a couple of days I was going to be a crazy blue chick, you know? So I got to play both ends of that spectrum.
Lucky you.
So I know. I was so lucky.
Very lucky. So do you either of you guys have any final thoughts or condolences for Leonard Nimoy as we get ready to sign off here?
I do have one thing I'd like to say. There's, I don't want to get too far into this subject, but there's been a lot of internet chatter about Shatner not making it to Nimoy's funeral. And for all the naysayers out there who just don't know the depths of what they're talking about, I recommend you watch the last chapter of a DVD called Mind Meld, which was made in 2001. It is Shatner and Nimoy sitting on Nimoy's patio, just talking about life and death. And you have to watch that final chapter because they talk about death and how it's coming up soon. And they talk about how close they are and that they're each other's best friends. So if you doubt that because of this funeral nonsense, and Shatner's a busy guy with a lot of charity work to do, very involved in the community, watch that. And if you have any question, that'll clear it up right there.
Yeah. So, you know, the good thing you brought that up. I don't know how many people are aware of this because this was a little underreported. You know, he did miss the funeral, but he did get there shortly thereafter and was able to attend a gathering, a post-funeral, if I read the articles correctly.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad he was able to do that. But frankly, I think that those two had the kind of relationship that would have been, you know, I'm sure that Leonard Nimoy would not have cared whether Shatner was at his funeral or not. You know, the understanding that those two had, the interaction that they had, I can't imagine that it would be of any consequence, you know, in the end.
Well, true friendship would transcend something like that.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So in closing, there was a line that one of our regular listeners had posted on Facebook in response to Leonard's passing that really stuck out to me, and I wanted to throw it out to the two of you and get your reactions from it because it's something that I had never thought about before. And he said, this was a guy by the name of Matt Walsky, and he said that, you know, Shatner or Kirk was the star, but Spock was the symbol of Star Trek. And that really kind of stuck out to me as something that I really didn't think a lot about. But do you other guys have any reaction to that statement?
I think of them all as symbols. I teach public speaking, and one of the things I teach is persuasion, how to persuade people. And Aristotle said that the three ways to persuade people are ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos is the credibility, the strength, which was Kirk. Pathos is the emotion, which was McCoy. And logos was the reason, the thought, the logical explanation, which was Spock.
Fascinating.
Fascinating.
That was my...
And when I think of them, I think of them as a triumvirate, as the way that humans connect with each other. And I think that all together they fulfilled that.
Excellent thoughts. Great way to expand on that. That's wonderful. And your perspective as a public speaking teacher is a really great analysis of the original series and the trinity of characters of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
Yeah. That's what they are, you know, and that's why they were so successful in what they did, because they had every aspect of what it takes to get people to do something. That's what they did.
Amazing. Vernon, any thoughts on that?
I 100% agree with what April said. And I also think that what the fan wrote on Facebook was well said. The way I look at it is every character on the original Star Trek was well thought out as representing a different aspect of humanity. And I think Spock is just looked at, the character of Spock was certainly the most exotic of all those characters. And that's why maybe that one character stands out more symbolically in everyone's head, referring to Star Trek than anyone else. So I think everybody's right.
Well, everybody is right.
Thank you very much for that. It's a great way to sign off. It's always a pleasure to have the two of you on the show. And hopefully We'll have the both of you back on again in the very near future.
Look forward to it.
Whenever you want.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on. It has been great, and we will see you soon.
Thank you.
All right.
So that was a fantastic tribute to Leonard Nimoy from our prior guests on the show. And Craig, if you will indulge me,
yes,
for a moment, I'd like to share one final thought on a non-Trek related Nimoy memory of mine.
Okay, cool, awesome.
From when I was really, really young. And I remember in the early days of the internet, I tried to look this up and I couldn't find any reference to it. And because I was so young when this was on the air, I actually started to question myself as to whether or not it really existed, but it actually does. And there was, as I grew up, I was born in the 70s, and you know, I spent a lot of time in the 80s watching television, like most of us did. And there was a network that debuted that was very, very popular back then, and it's still popular today, called Nickelodeon. And I'm sure many of our guests have heard of that. And on Nickelodeon, back in the early 80s, there was a television show that I recalled watching called Stand By, Lights, Camera, Action.
Mm.
And it was hosted by Leonard Nimoy. I've since found evidence that it did exist. Of course, there are clips of it on YouTube and things now that the internet has become what it is today. And you can feel free to look this up, and I'll have a link to it. But I remember watching this show as a young child, and I'll read the description of it from Wikipedia. And Stand By, Lights, Camera, Action is an educational TV show that was aired on Nickelodeon from May 1982 to December 31st, 1987. The show's main focus was to teach children of all ages what occurs behind the scenes of movie productions. And I remember hearing Leonard Nimoy and seeing Leonard Nimoy talk through all of these popular movies and going behind the scenes, and there were on-set footage pieces with him, and there were moments where he would talk about building props and how lighting worked, and it really gave me as a child an appreciation of movies and how movies were made. And some of the movies that they talked about, and some of them that I remember seeing, were Star Wars: The Return of the Jedi, Search for Spock, there was some James Bond coverage, The Secret of Nim, which is a very, very awesome movie if you haven't seen it. One of my favorites. It was a Don Bluth animated film. The Dark Crystal, another Jim Henson movie. Octopussy, Craig, for you. Lots and lots and lots of movies in that time period were discussed and dived into in depth on that show. And that was something that really stands out in my own memory as a show that Leonard Nimoy was a big part of. That was a big part of my childhood.
That's excellent. I really am not remembering that show right now. Doesn't mean I didn't see it, and it sounds fascinating. I would love to see some of those episodes.
Yeah, I'm gonna look on YouTube and see how much of that I can find. And I don't think that's ever been released on DVD or VHS to my knowledge. But there's no reference to it here. But hopefully somebody has captured some of it and it's available on YouTube. I'll find what I can find and post it in the show notes.
Excellent, excellent. I guess so. That brings us to the end of this this tribute episode to the life and wonderful career of Leonard Nimoy. We thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode, and we thank everybody who helped make this episode possible by offering their thoughts and memories of Leonard Nimoy.
Been an emotional roller coaster, I think, for you and I, and for everybody else, yep, who's been a part of this episode, and everybody who's listening to this. Thanks for taking that ride with us, and you know, thanks for helping us to celebrate the life of Leonard Nimoy.
Right on. And I guess we will see you next time for another regularly scheduled commentary episode.